In a world haunted by tourists and crippled by mass transit delays, where the outlook is bleak and creativity has been sapped, two artists will unite their passion and dare to strip away the bullshit and talk about movies. Movies in the Buff.
Open it.
Now we've got a man waiting for sentence. But ain't it the truth? You take your chances with the law. Justice is only a roll of the dice, a flip of the coin, a turn of the wheel.
All right. You ready to go?
Yeah.
Let's do it. Welcome to Mad Max May, Beyond Thunderdome week. Bitches. Yep. Yes, we're at our third week with Mad Max.
I thought you were going to open with like a Tina Turner song or something.
What's Max got to do with it? Got to do with it. You brought that on yourself.
Did I?
Yes, you did. Because I didn't even think about that. That would have been brilliant. All right, start over. No, we're not going to start over.
No,
okay.
No, no.
So, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome this week. Next week, we're finishing out all of the Mad Max movies that are currently out.
Watchable.
Watchable. In the saga with Fury Road. But this week, we got some awesome 80s banging.
It's a movie.
It's a movie that we watched, and we're excited about it. I'm still drinking.
And it has surprisingly great reviews.
Does it really?
Yeah. What? Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars.
Wow. Good for him, man. Living his best life.
Yeah.
Living his best life when this movie, 1985, he was feeling good watching this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm still drinking Outlaw whiskey. Has a nice Robitussin feel to it. It's from Mystic Mountain Distillery, and apparently it's inspired by the legends and outlaws of the Old West. And there's a lot
sarsaparilla.
Of coughing and cholera, and so people needed to use this as medicine, which is why it's kind of a medicinal quality. Brett, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking Basil Hayden's. Cheers.
Basil Hayden's. Cheers, dude. Man, it is so funny how much that tastes like Robitussin. Like, legit, like it tastes like I'm drinking Robitussin, which is hilarious. So the execs at HBO Max have still been enjoying our podcast, and so they've kept Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome on HBO Max for our month, which has been very nice of them. They're very great, nice people over at HBO Max, and we appreciate your listenership. So this is the synopsis from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Max stumbles onto a desert city in the post-apocalyptic world that is built on the principle of unbridled cutthroat capitalism, where anything, even a human life, can be bartered.
Great. Yeah, sure.
I guess it doesn't say anything about plot. It's just like, Remember those Mad Max movies? This is another one. Mel Gibson, Tina Turner, 1985.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. Man. Yeah. So I kind of had this realization during all of these movies, and it hit me again in watching this one where I was like, I've definitely seen this one, and I remembered this one and Road Warrior much more than I remembered the first one. But there were definitely large segments of this movie that I was like, oh, I do not remember any of this happening over here.
You mean like when he turns into Peter Pan?
Yeah, when he goes and then it becomes Hook is what I don't remember about it. I was like, I think I just remember watching Hook instead. But yeah, so that's a reason to rewatch movies, even though you're like, oh yeah, no, Mad Max. I've seen Mad Max. I know Mad Max. Then you rewatch them and you're like, wow, great. So we've done West Side Story in our Mad Max month. We've done Clockwork Orange in Mad Max month. Fucking Hook, all sorts of stuff. But the first thing that I loved about this movie, my very first note, music, 80s, fucking were in it. And oh, I laughed sorts, so hard.
Totally, man.
So good. You're like, oh, okay, we are, this is a different look for Mad
break
Max.
Break out those synths, man.
Oh, man, so much synth. And then it said that, which I didn't know, that Maurice Jarre did the score for this, which is crazy. Never would have thought that he did a Mad Max movie. For those of you who don't know who that is, he did the score for Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago and fucking Ghost. And we did it on this podcast, I think. Dead Poets Society.
Oh.
As well. So you're like, What are you doing with Tina Turner and, you know, and Mel Gibson and Beyond Thunderdome, Maurice? Crazy old Maurice.
Though, I mean, it kind of makes Zhivago and Arabia make sense in that they're similar grandiose epics set in deserts.
Definitely.
At varying times.
Definitely. And my overall thought on this score, just since I started talking about it, is that the score is better than the movie can handle.
Probably, yeah.
From a composition standpoint, I think. Because I feel like it makes this movie feel like Lawrence of Arabia when it is in fact not Lawrence of Arabia. You know, not of that quality and caliber, you know. Tries to make it feel like this, like epic. When you're like, no, man, just stick with your composers from the other ones, and just like have some weird soundtracks, you know?
Yeah. I have to say, the music didn't. I don't know. I have a tendency to write off movies of this period and their music because it just isn't anything that does anything for me.
Yeah.
Typically. And it was more of the same here where I was just like, okay, like I get it within the first 5 minutes and then just kind of stop listening to the music really. Yeah. Cause there's so many other delightful and odd things to think about when this movie is going on. Sure. And this opening is kind of bizarre, like, especially because it's, you know, we're introduced to Bruce Spence's character in this movie, the pilot, which is different character from the gyro captain.
Yeah.
But they both are flying machine survivalists, which is really confusing for that to be the first character that you see. And to also be in this, you know, vast desert with no other signs of life. And then we find out that people have reverted to using camels and horses, and Max has grown a ridiculous mullet. That's
awesome, dude. When he comes on screen with the long hair, my note literally is, yes, queen.
It's yeah. I mean, he took his fashion stylings from the Feral Kid.
It's the same one. It's the Feral Kid grown up.
Oh my God. Mind blown. You'll never. you'll never believe this ridiculous theory. Click below.
Exactly. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the opening shot also reminded me of Evil Dead, where it's just like you're just sort of like swooping and following and everything. And you're it and then landed. So I just kind of this movie also, a lot of this movie reminded me of Evil Dead. But this was the first thing that maybe it got me thinking about it. And then as the movie went on, I was like, that's the same, that kind of thing. I'll call them out as we get to them. Don't you worry. Never mm-hmm. you fret.
Not worried.
A little nervous, a little upset, but not worried. But yeah, I think that it was just something that, because we watched it recently, that swooping kind of opening shot was interesting. But yeah, and then we get to Bartertown. Right away.
City in the middle of fucking nowhere, Bartertown.
Yep.
And you know, we start to get some pretty some clues pretty quickly as to what has happened to our society here. Because the guy that, you know, as they're schlepping into Bartertown, there's a guy selling, you know, clean in inverted commas water. And Max pulls out a radiation gun and is like, no fucking way.
Yeah. Right.
And we're all like, okay, so there's been, the drinking water is contaminated. Our resources are even more depleted than they were in the previous iteration of this movie. Mm-hmm. And so we have a pretty, pretty clear idea that there's been some sort of war or apocalyptic scenario, presumably nuclear, wherein there was a large destruction that can, you know, ruin a lot of shit.
Yeah.
One of the things that bugs me about this movie is last week you talked about enjoying the comedy more in Road Warrior than you did in the first one. Mm-hmm. And here in this movie, it gets a little shticky for me in certain parts. And like, there's some pretty like classic gimmicks. Right here we get one where, you know, he argues his way into Bartertown, by saying like, I can fight or whatever, and then turns in all of his guns. And it's like, okay, we've seen the sawed off shotgun, and it goes clunk. And then he pulls out another one, clunk. And then another one, clunk, clunk, two out, clunk, 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 clunk. And then like a handful of shotgun shells.
Yeah, right.
which is very funny and is a classic kind of gimmick in these types of movies, action movies, that is, right? Like it's kind of like I'm trying to think of another movie where we see that exact same thing happen.
It's like The Mummy.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if like that happens in The Mummy, but it feels like that would happen in The Mummy.
Totally. Or really any movie that Harrison Ford is in.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones or Star Wars specifically, like that mm-hmm. kind of, like, there are a lot of Indiana Jones vibes in this movie too.
Totally.
You know, again, perfect example. Another one of the shticky things, like later when he's chasing the blacksmith and it's, you know, attack, attack, attack. And he's chasing the guy into the little hall, and then it's an immediate U-turn and he comes running back out the other way as the entire horde of, you know, underworld workers comes with him.
Yep.
But for what I don't know, I think it kind of detracts a little bit from this world. And I understand, like, you can't have a movie that is going to be advertised as an action movie be all drama for 90 minutes of it, and then have 17 minutes of action at the end. So you have to have something to bring a little bit of levity. And like, Max is always like, there's always been a little bit of this, but for me, it's just a little too campy, I think.
I agree completely. Completely. Like, it doesn't fit this. And like, everything, my biggest issue with this movie is that nothing seems to fit. Like, the music doesn't fit with this. Like, you need something like music from The Mummy that's like kind of epic, but also kind of campy, not like legit epic, you know. The story is kind of the all over the place where you're like, so wait, what's the point? Like, why am I, what is happening? And then the comedy, same thing. You're like, this doesn't, on paper, sure, it's funny, but like, yeah, I mean, this movie is a mix of fucking Evil Dead, well, really Army of Darkness, Hook, and Indiana Jones. That's what this movie is. That's the three.
Yeah, I mean, it really does kind of feel like Indiana Jones and Army of Darkness had a baby.
Yeah,
especially maybe because more like Evil Dead 2 in term. I don't know,
man.
Evil Dead 2 is a good movie.
Yeah, Army of Darkness is campy. They take everything that was like, you know.
Whatever. Yeah, I guess I was trying to put something that this would actually have reference to, right? Because Army of Darkness comes out 7 years after this,
right?
And now I'm wondering, like, how much of Army of Darkness, like,
is based on this movie? Man.
How much do you look at this movie and go, "Oh, that was a good gimmick for my movie"?
I'm serious, dude. He walks into Bartertown, and I'm like, it's almost like the exact same shot of when Bruce Campbell walks into the like old English camp, even so much so as Mel Gibson waving around his boomstick. Like, This is my boomstick is one of my notes in here. Like, he walks into this fucking town, you know, and everyone's like, whoa.
It's just, yeah, the movie just doesn't feel very cohesive.
Yeah.
There are really interesting scenes and bits and bobs. And I'm now wildly curious to go and read reviews after you and I talk to see what people actually like. I was just kind of looking at the critical aggregators, and you know little snippets and whatnot, and like, I don't know, maybe it's because it's still a decent movie and it's not absolutely terrible. Mm-hmm. And it's also probably the second Mad Max movie most people had seen.
Yeah, right.
They're just like, right. I want more of this world, and here's more of this world. And the, you know, the ending chase sequence is really exciting. I'm sure was really exciting in 1985 too. So yeah. Well, it leaves you with a good taste in your mouth.
The height of Tina Turner's fame is right now. You know, 1985. To be completely transparent, I watched the Tina Turner documentary called Tina on HBO Max.
That just came out, right?
Yeah, it came out maybe a month ago, maybe, but still pretty new, and I hadn't seen it yet. And I, you know, clearly knew Tina Turner and knew about Ike Turner and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't really know any of her story. I knew her songs, but I never, just kind of one of the artists that kind of slipped underneath my radar as far as their story. And so, you know, I'll spare everyone the review of that documentary. But when it comes around to Mad Max time, as is pertinent for this episode, you know, she had already reinvented herself as the rocker chick. The What's Love Got to Do with It is just came out. She's a huge famous star. And so her being in this movie instantly raises the box office because everyone is obsessed with Tina Turner right now. So I think that might also have affected people's viewing of it too.
Yeah.
In the time.
Yeah. Makes sense.
But speaking of the town of Bartertown, I do like the design of it. I think like just all of the, I want to call out the set decoration and whatnot of just creating this real town is just all the odds and ends and like the costuming of all the background actors, like, fucking cool.
Yeah, it's got a cool like kind of steampunk aesthetic to it.
Yeah, big time. Yeah. And that's cool. I dig it.
Yeah, I do too. I think it works really well for this world. I mean, it seems in keeping with everything we know about these about the at least the nomadic peoples of Mad Max's Australia. Yeah, I dig it. I dig the design in general. I think they do a really great job with most of the sets. Though the Thunderdome set is very clearly on a soundstage somewhere.
Without a doubt.
And just it feels very not rooted in the world's reality.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to that here in a minute. But yeah, Max very coyly not very coyly, but he very aggressively actually goes after the Dr. Dealgood, the master of ceremonies. Like, those are my camels, bitch. but then, you know, makes his way up into the bird's nest is what I call it.
Yeah.
Kind of, cause I don't know. I've always envisioned Tina Turner in this movie, or envision Auntie in this movie as a bird. Mm. Just she like always is flying down from places and
yeah, totally. Like that's so true.
The feathered hair and
yep.
Yeah. And it's just the most bizarre 80s sax solo.
like it's almost to that effect where you're like, Bernie.
Yeah, it's like you're walking into like a film noir or you know, some gritty detective's office and it's yeah, it's really odd. It's
the
so
first thing that I
odd.
Thought of was just his wife when he came home and she
oh my
was
God, yeah,
saxophone,
of course.
You know?
Of course.
So I think that might be what
it's
the
so random.
Yeah. I was like, what is this supposed to be a callback? Is this supposed to be like a throwback to the first one? Is this not at all? Like
yeah,
you
instead
know.
It's like a blind servant, which whatever.
And like, Tina's just says something like, play something tragic. And then he just plays like an old bluesy jazz song or whatever. I'm like, I guess this is kind of tragic, yeah, but
Kenny G over here in the corner.
Yeah, right. Like, what is happening?
Yeah. It's bizarre. This whole scene is bizarre. Their discussion is bizarre. I feel like Tina's scenes settle in a little bit more as the movie goes on. And they can also hold her kind of grandiose presence a bit better. Yeah. But here it's just like, you know, it reminds me of like something out of an Austin Powers movie, man. Like it's kind of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, I can't quite put my finger on what exactly I just kind of watch this movie with my mouth agape a lot of the times. Where it was, I don't know. I spend a lot of time watching movies and whatnot, obviously, and have gotten to a point where if I start to get ahead of things, I'll then like go, okay, I know where this is going. I can kind of tune out a little bit and start reconcile, like, okay, so why are they doing this? What does this purpose? What does this, you know, what is this setting up to? Yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And I never was able to do that with this movie. It always was just like the next step never really made sense. Like, you know, we have this meeting and then we go into the underworld and then we're in the Thunderdome in like 12 minutes. And you're like, wait a second. I thought the Thunderdome, like surely this has more of a role to play than just like setting the plot in motion.
Yeah.
Nope. The answer is no.
Brett, do you know what this movie's called?
It's called Beyond.
Beyond. No, I only said that because I had the same thought when I was watching. I was like, can't wait for the Thunderdome. And then like 10 minutes into the movie, it's like, it's the Thunderdome. And then it's over for the rest of the 2 hours that this movie is. You're like, what happened to the Thunderdome? I want to go back to the Thunderdome.
I'm going to play in the Thunderdome.
I want to play the Thunderdome again. I want to see motorcycles in there or some shit.
The fight they have in the bird's nest here is really not great.
No.
There's some really bad hand-to-hand choreo here.
Yeah. Which Mel Gibson's hair and Tina Turner's hair are awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I should say Tina's hair and Mel's wig.
It's wild, man. It's wild. Yeah, this is just, it's not a very well executed fight scene, in my opinion.
I agree.
It feels very like first day of, you know, choreographing a fight scene where you're going at 1/10 of a speed. Sometimes you're like, all right, and then I'm going to bring my right hand and try to punch you in your left cheek and you're going to duck and dodge. It felt like, I don't know. It felt like they kind of, it felt hurried. Yeah. And probably a lot of that's probably to do with the editing too, of just, or not getting the right angles or not getting the right takes maybe. So who knows? It's also interesting to consider that George Miller, at least by the way the title card works, did not direct this movie exclusively, that there is a second director involved. George Ogilvy. Mm-hmm. Jeff Ogilvy was a professional athlete at some point, I think. For something. I don't know.
Brett went deep into his almanac Rolodex brain of sports knowledge.
He was definitely a professional athlete. I just can't remember for who or what sport.
That's awesome.
Oh, he's a golfer. He's a golfer.
Okay, good. I just saw like Brett's brain like open up and then like
just all of the useless sports trivia. Oh man, it's the truth. Yeah. Though
apparently George Miller only directed the like action set pieces and that was it.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does. And it makes a lot of sense when you're looking at both what we have already mentioned with the like lack of cohesion to the vision of the movie, how different this movie is from the previous two, how yeah. much more complicated and oh god, the word just escaped
far me. Less economical.
Oh yeah, economic. Yeah,
like
yeah. And I guess the reason behind that is, number one, George Miller, when he wanted to, he never wanted to make a third Mad Max movie. He wanted Road Warrior to be it. He goes off into the sunset or whatever, and that's it. And then he came to the studio. The studios came to him and said something like, "We want you to direct a Children of the Corn remake." And he's like, "Well, what if it's Mad Max with Children of the Corn? That's interesting." And then they were like, "All right, that's cool. We can get Tina Turner." And he's like, "Cool, that's awesome." And then one of his best or closest friends, who is a producer, died in a helicopter crash while location scouting. And from then on out, he was like, my heart's not in this movie anymore. I can't tell the story like I originally wanted to. I'm too in my head about it or whatever. And so they brought in George Ogilvy. Is that how you say his name? Ogilvy? Make sure.
Ogilvy. Yeah.
Yep. So that's why George Miller was there for clearly the like last 10 minutes of the movie scene, which is like, oh, there's my Mad Max, and like the Thunderdome fight. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely feels like this, that there needed to be a stronger guiding voice in this.
Yeah.
Just tighter. Yeah. So the birds.
So we flash to the like the pig farms below after Mel Gibson proves himself, right? Yeah. And I just have to say, like, they, you know, before they even talked about like shoveling shit and using it manure and methane as a whatever, my first thought when we just see the clips, I was like, holy shit, could you imagine the smell down there?
Oh,
and then
yeah.
they go into being like, oh no, because we use pig shit to, and I was like, oh my god, like, could you imagine?
Methane cometh from pig shit.
I wrote that line down too because I was like, what is happening?
I love like
Master Blaster
bastardizing old English or you know, middle English.
Yep.
Yeah, so Master Blaster, which is a great name for
it's
a villain.
Awesome.
Great.
Yep.
And I actually think I think they do a pretty, for 1985 especially, I think they do a pretty good job using Angelo Rizzito well. I think he has it's not just exploitative of his size. Mm-hmm. Obviously there is a lot, there is some of that. I mean, the whole concept is that he is a small person on top of a large person.
Right. And he's the brain and the.
Yeah. And the other one is the brawn. Yeah. But I feel like they do give him a lot to do, and he has a three-dimensional character that has motivations and has wants and desires and has feelings. And obviously, I mean, Angelo Rizzito is a famous actor. He's in a fucking 100 movies or whatever. Mm-hmm. Dating back to like silent film era stuff, right?
Oh, really? I didn't know it was that far back.
Like maybe not.
It might be.
Maybe not that far. I feel like it was, though. Can't go. Doesn't matter. Open up. I've actually downloaded all of IMDb into my head. but no, he was around for quite a bit and in a lot of things. And I think he does a really nice job in this movie. Mm-hmm. The things that I don't like about that character aren't his fault. Mm-hmm. Particularly the speech pattern that doesn't really jibe in any real sense with the rest of the world around him. For being the brains, having a stunted speech pattern like that, where, you know, he's essentially doing the why use lot word when few word do trick.
Yeah. Me want control. You give control.
Right.
What? You're the brains. You figured out how to like use methane to power a whole fucking city. Like,
who runs Barta Town? Yeah. And I think, you know, I think it's probably intentional in that it's yet another way to try to other him, as somebody that was either affected by the nuclear blast or, has, you know, incredible, is not an educated human being necessarily, but has, you know, the street smarts of how to run the underworld type thing. But we also find that out to not really be true later. So I don't know. And nobody else speaks in that pattern except for our lost boys. And that's because their parents died in the apocalypse and they didn't get an education.
Right. And they have their own full like language that like master is speaking in, like you said, like me want this, who run Barter Town, this, like that. Whereas the kids like made up their own language.
Right. But apart from that, I love the design. I love the rig that they've set up for him. Mm-hmm. Is really interesting, and it's an intimidating character too. Like this, you know, huge man in an iron, you know, in an iron helmet. And yeah, I don't know. It fits perfectly within this world, right? It is, you know, quintessential outcast like we've seen so many times so far. And so, yeah, I really dig Master Blaster for the most part. And also just Master Blaster is such a great fucking name. George Miller does know how to name people, man. I said it in the first movie, but
it's so true, dude.
Toe Cutter, the humongous Master Blaster, mm-hmm. Auntie Entity, Rictus Erectus, Immortan Rictus Joe.
Mm-hmm. Immortan like, Joe is so good. Yeah.
I also really like this set design, I think the most of anything.
Of the underworld?
Of the sets, yeah. I think this aesthetic is really whole and really thought out. And it seems intentional in the way that it's set up. You can kind of follow the machining of it, in kind of an industrial way that makes sense to how the work flows down there. Which is something that I really appreciate it. And I felt like whenever we are down there, the movie knows what it's trying to do. It knows what it is. Those scenes felt very complete to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree completely, man. Yeah, so then Max is down there. He gets himself down there and working with it with all of them. He figures out that Blaster doesn't like loud noises.
Yeah, of course, the traditional movie trope of the big, you know, every villain has some kryptonite, right? And it's normally something really stupid, like a high-pitched whistle.
Like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I, you know, the Down syndrome special needs element that comes into play, we can talk about when we get there, but I guess it can track in that way.
Yeah, I mean, if he's 100%, sensory issues are often a large part of both Down syndrome and autism spectrum disorders and mm-hmm. things like that. So
absolutely, yep. And then we get our "Who runs Baby Town?"
Yeah, she just gave you away your line for the last.
No, they say Barter Town and bit so many. Like, there's got to be Baby Town's got to be Barter Town somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, it is. This exchange through the little telescope thing is fun too. This power dynamic, and this is where the movie just kind of like doesn't really make sense to me. Mm-hmm. Like, Master Blaster is, I guess, the only one that really understands how this methane gas harvesting works, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm like, you already built the thing. Now we just shovel shit into that pool over there and we get electricity. Like, if he leaves, we now know how it works.
Yeah, right.
Like, I don't know what other knowledge that he has that he's holding over everyone's head outside of the fact that no one wants to be in that.
Yeah, shit, right. He's the only one that's willing to be down there.
Yeah, I guess. But I agree. I'm like, with this power dynamic struggle is like, on like, if you don't think at all about it, where you're like, oh, this person runs the above world and this person runs the below world, and they both want to be, you know,
and more in power,
the leader, and that's it. Like, okay, sure, that makes sense. If I don't look at any plot, and especially because then this whole power dynamic plot and everything, like, is like the first quarter of the movie, like maybe not even that much. Like, it's the first little bit of the movie and the last little bit of the movie, but the whole middle part has nothing to do with Bartertown, Thunderdome, Master Blaster, Anti. Like, none of that has anything to do with anything.
Nope.
So that's also where I get with this, where I'm like, you're trying to explore this, you know, trying to explore Bartertown and trying to explore what, you know, and then you don't, and then it just, you abandon it.
The movie gets lost in its own meta theatrics, right? It tries to take this movie and tell it from the point of view of one of the child survivors. And, you know, it's yet another story in the ongoing mythos of this man named Max. I mean, they literally, and we'll talk about it in a second, but they literally call him the man with no name.
I know. It's like, woohoo.
Right. And it's very, you know, it's very clear that that George Miller is pulling from that kind of storytelling too, where we're not working with necessarily a linear plot structure, or, you know, the idea that all of these movies all happened. It's rather these retellings of the different people that encountered a Max-like figure in their life. And so I think the movie gets lost in trying to establish too much of Bartertown as a way to get Max to these kids and then bring the kids back to Bartertown. It just kind of gets lost in the fray and doesn't really know what story it wants to tell, and gets lost in this idea that, well, if the kids are telling the story, that's what's going to be the most salient and clean, mm-hmm. and everything else is going to be muddled or could be muddled. And I don't know. And all the while too, we're still making a movie in the 1980s. So like, we're at the time of, you know, cinema's getting really big in the States in terms of blockbuster cinema. And you can't make, like we saw with James Cameron, right? Like, can't make a movie that's over 2 hours. Nobody will see it.
Which is funny because with this movie,
right, this movie is 20 minutes longer than the first two.
Right. And I'm like, we could cut that 20 minute. Like, this movie needs to be 90 minutes.
We either need to lose 20 minutes or add another half an hour.
Right.
In order for all of this to make some sort of sense.
Yep.
Because, you know, by the time that we're back with Anti-Entity and Max is challenging Master Blaster to a duel. We're 30 minutes into the movie.
Right.
And it feels like it's just been exposition to this point.
Oh, it has. Like nothing's actually happened.
Yeah, it's it's pretty wild, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, then we're go for it. Yeah.
I don't know what to, like, this is, it's so all over the place. Like, I was going to say, I think in trying to decode this movie, I think really the plot, you know, like the point of it to me seems to be trying to allow Mac, the character of Max, to rediscover his humanity.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of the whole mythos of this, or the motif of this story, right? Or not a motif, theme, is Max suffers a great trial in his, or tribulation in his life, trials and tribulations, and then goes into the West and is encountered with a number of different scenarios where he tries to find out who he is again, and is tested to see if there's still a human inside him.
Yeah. Because when you think of Max in Road Warrior, it's, you know, the name Warrior. It's cold. It's calculated. I don't give a fuck about you guys. Like, give me the gas and I'm out. I don't care. Though he still does deep down. Whereas in this one, it's like he doesn't kill Blaster because no one knows why, but he doesn't, because it doesn't feel right or whatever. And then he like becomes Jeff Goldblum in The Lost World, and it's just with a bunch of different kids and you know, and rediscovering that element of it. And I wonder if it was in a way to try and put a little bow on Mel Gibson's Max, because it was clear after this movie he was not going to ever come back to do another Mad Max movie. And so I wonder how much of it was like, okay, we got to leave Max in a good place. We got to leave this character in a good place for people to be like, good, we're done with it.
Yeah. You know,
maybe. But other than, like, that's the only thing I can think of as to, like, what the fuck is the point of this movie?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's their Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi is a better movie than Beyond Thunderdome.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it is. For me,
I think it probably is.
Yeah, but
I think Return of the Jedi is, well, let's not.
Can't get into Star Wars.
Yeah, but we can go to WWE Hell in a Cell.
Let's do it.
Which is what this is.
Yep.
On elastic trapezes.
Yeah, which I have some questions about that, but we'll get there when we get there. She does give like a good old Thunderdome speech, which is good, where she's like, this is the Thunderdome. Two men enter, one man leaves. You know the rules. Like that whole speech, you're like, fucking get it, Tina. Just like, get it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all very hyped up, and like, this is also right in this is right when WWF is taking off, right?
Yeah.
In the mid 80s. It has wrestling vibes to it.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Before we get into the actual fight itself, I just want to call out a couple of things. First thing, love the lighting choice of seeing Tina in the bird's nest. Is that what you called it? The nest? Because I think that's the perfect term for it. But it's like she's all backlit and her silhouette is, you know, with the hair and the big shoulder pads and, you know, this like shocking white light with the smoke. I think that was kind of cool. But again, it's like a WWF or now WWE like entrance. Yeah. And then the fucking zip line that she like rides down. I'm like, this is fun. This is cool. And I just love the circular shot, the 360 shot when we like first enter the Thunderdome And then we just circle around and we see the entire dome covered with background actors or stunt people or whatever, but just like entire thing covered. I think that's pretty cool.
Oh yeah. The whole really cool swirling camera aesthetic is really well done. And it does a really great job capturing the, like the circus aspect to this. Yes. Right. You know, Dr. Dealgood is doing his best Jim Broadbent and Moulin Rouge, like,
because you can't get good.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, yeah, it is. You both know the rules. There are no rules or whatever. You don't worry about breaking them. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I expect a good, clean fight. Everyone's going to follow the rules because there are no rules. We're like, oh, okay. And everyone's chanting, two men enter, one man leave. And it like builds and crescendos. And then fucking Dr. Strangelove or whatever, like, cuts everyone off. And you're like, what? What is happening? Like, that dude's so weird.
Yeah. It's
such a weird dude. Like, what is his... What does Dr. Good do? What's his name?
Dealgood.
What's he do when he's not like... Because to me, it seems like he's Thunderdome isn't an every Friday night thing. It's like, we only use Thunderdome when there's a dispute. And maybe there are a bunch of disputes in Bartertown.
It's a Bartertown. Of course there are disputes.
Yeah, I guess so. So like, why is everyone so excited about it if it happens like three times a day? You got like the matinee show of Thunderdome.
Well, everybody like knows Master Blaster.
Well, yeah. And so it's Master Blaster with anybody else all the time.
Well, no. I think this is one of the few times that Master Blaster or that Blaster has gone to the Thunderdome. Yeah.
That makes sense. Well, it can't be one of the first, but yeah, I agree that it's got to be very
it's a rare occasion, right?
Yeah. Because people don't have to fuck with him.
It feels like the entire conceit of this is that there is no justice system aside from this and the wheel.
Yeah. The fucking Wheel of Fortune comes in here, like, and you get Vanna
White.
They're
all
like,
terrible options.
There is one good option, I think. There was one option that's like, all is forgiven.
Spin
or
again.
Yeah. The spin again one's brutal. anyway, continue.
Yeah, no, I think that's what the, you know, I think every dispute, there are a lot of disputes that are handled in Thunderdome. But it's rare to get somebody as prevalent like Blaster involved.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah. And then we have this really famous fight scene that, again, I'm just kind of mystified by.
How does the science work? Did you have any issues with the physics of this thing where how the bungee trapeze thing works? Cause I'm like, sometimes I grab the person and he goes flying, but other times he's just like walking around, so it doesn't seem like there's a lot of, like, it seems like the tautness of the bungee is fluctuates. Like, it seems like sometimes they can just like squat down and fly to the ceiling, and sometimes they can squat down and just sit on the ground with no issue.
There is also probably, you know, it could be a situation where there's two sets of bungees within a single set, one that is taut from top to bottom when you're standing and walking around, but is not necessarily as strong as the other bungee, and only when the other bungee is extended at full capacity are you able to launch yourself across the way.
Okay. I buy that. That's all I needed. I believe this movie now.
Great.
No, but yeah, that's good. That's good to know, because I was curious about it. It wasn't something I was like upset about, but I was just curious about how that worked, because it's fucking cool, man. I think
it is cool. The sound mix,
cool
sucks.
Lighting, and yeah, the sound mix isn't good.
There's a lot of like Adam West Batman happening.
Yes.
Whack.
Right. Yeah, and the scoring is kind of weird during it too. It's like a kind of metallic, like bunch of people like banging on pipes with some like horns in there too.
Yeah,
it just doesn't really fit. We need some like This would be a prime candidate for like a Tina Turner rock song happening right now, or like AC/DC, or like, you know, something heavy metal.
I actually don't mind the scoring here. I like the pipe element, the kind of like found aesthetic of it. I don't know.
That's fair.
I'm glad they don't put soundtrack in this movie.
Fight choreo's cool. It's very, like you mentioned, yeah, WWE wrestling. This is my next instance of that Max is actually Bruce Campbell, because he goes and gets the chainsaw. Fucking chainsaw. I'm like, okay, so now he's got the chainsaw. All right. Yep. He's got his boomstick and a chainsaw.
Absolutely.
And then he stops. Did you want to talk any more specifics about the fight?
No, I don't think so.
A lot of cool badass choreography stuff, and the flying around is fun, and
lots of flips and shit, and that's all great and well and good. I still think the whistle is cheap and weird.
And how often he like almost gets it, but then he just not quite, and then he has it in his mouth.
I accidentally kicked it across the entire dome. Shit.
Yeah, I'm getting hugged by Blaster, and he's giving me the Heimlich, so I have to spit it across the whole dome. Yep.
Yeah. His discovery that he wasn't fighting who he thought he was fighting, in terms of the, you know, Blaster's relative ability to know what he's up against and know what he's doing and knowing what kind of circumstance he's putting himself in. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Master yells out like he has the mind of he's no more than a child or whatever. Mm-hmm. Clearly is what gets to Max. Go for
it. Absolutely, I agree. And also, like, his interaction with in the first movie, there was a who we described as a Lenny-esque character. So I wonder if some of that was like a bringing him back to his past moment as well, of like rediscovering his, you know, things that he'd have locked away, memories he's had locked away or whatever. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is that I had a little issue with this, where you're like, the character of Master goes running in there. Stop. He doesn't know what he's doing. And I'm like, bitch, you're the one that put him in there. Like, you're the one that's feeding him on. Like, you can't just pull this card right now when you're like, no way. Like, you're the one pulling all of his strings and making him do this horrible shit.
Yeah, but it was never in his realm of possibility that he would lose. That wasn't even a consideration.
But that still doesn't make it better for me, because for me, I go, you're the reason you're okay with this, Master, is that you know that your guy can just fucking fuck up everybody in gruesome, horrible ways, and that's not good either.
Absolutely. I don't think that he asks for Thunderdome if it's ever in his realm of possibility that Blaster could lose. Mm-hmm. I don't think he in any way thinks he's subjugating Master to, or subjugating Blaster to any sort of harm or threat. And it's only in the moment where he is about to lose him does he realize what he has done, and is trying to stop the whole proceeding, knowing what it will do to him and Blaster should he live. I think, it's him trying to, I don't think he's trying to say, oh, like, deals off, you know, this wasn't a fair fight or whatever. I think it's much more in the world of him trying to keep a place in the world where he can feel safe and protected and not feel bullied and not be an indentured servant and not, or, you know, not go to prison or whatever. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't feel like the movie asks for us in this particular moment to feel sympathy for Master. It's only later when he's starting to be subjugated to the pigs and, clearly, you know, is not in control, like, at points in time is not in control of his own body. Because he just gets picked up and moved around and things like that. Right. It's only through that journey do we start to realize what this man has probably gone through in an effort just to survive.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah. The stop the, you know, stop the proceedings thing doesn't bug me in that way.
Yeah. No, that's good. That makes more sense to me too. You know, looking deeper into his character in that way, that it's actually a protective thing and a thing of kindness rather than an exploitative thing. Makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
For
yeah.
sure.
And then we get another one of our chanting rhymes. Bust the deal, break the wheel, bust the deal. Or no, spin the wheel.
No.
Face the wheel.
Face the wheel.
Face
yeah.
the wheel. Jesus.
Bust a deal, face the wheel. Bust a deal, face the wheel. It makes total sense where you're like, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Like,
oh yeah.
It's huge in the zeitgeist where the 80s are about chants and rhymes is what I've come to learn.
Yeah.
Like a virgin.
Yeah, but this wheel, like, the wheel is like, and the wheel doesn't make any sense because, like, he lands on Gulag, which in my mind, yeah, is definitely not the desert.
No.
Like, a Gulag is like a prison.
Yeah. Yeah, I was totally ready for some, like, badass steampunk prison. And then he's like, okay, you get to go to the desert now. I was like, well, why doesn't it just say desert then? Why is this a Gulag? Right.
Or exile. Or,
yeah. It's so true. It said Gulag. I got so
Sarlacc
excited.
Pit. Like,
yeah, right. Right.
I love that one of the choices is Auntie's choice.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the punishment can be just whatever she decides she wants it to be in that moment.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, this movie's a fucking mess, man.
Yeah, my next note is, what is happening right now? Big old head on him.
Yeah, when he's sitting backwards on the horse and they put the mask on.
It's not a mask, it's a fucking, like, mascot. Like,
yeah,
like,
right.
When I think mask, I think, like, masquerade. Like,
oh, yeah. No, it's like...
It is a mask.
It's like a fucking, like, big boy head.
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean, it's like, you think about, like, a Mickey Mouse head when you go to Disney World or whatever. It's like, they put that on it, except it's not felt. It's fucking metal or plastic or whatever. Like,
yeah, right.
So do they, like, just have, like, is this every time someone faces the Gulag, they always put this one same head on the guy, so does someone have to go out and, like, find
go
the
and
head
retrieve it? Yeah.
Or do they just have, like, an excess of, like, weird shit that they put on people and he just happened to be the big boy head? Like,
yeah, I have no fucking clue, man.
Like, what is that about?
I don't know.
Oh man,
I don't know.
And then this is another one of those, like, man with no name things, because this whole thing reminds me of Good, the Bad, and the Ugly when Clint Eastwood's going into the desert.
It is 100% that scene.
Yeah, has to be. Yeah, and then my next question is, why does this convict even like Max? Like, we meet that pig convict, the pig killer, who, you know, killed a pig to feed his family or whatever. Max goes down to the pit way, like, earlier in the movie or whatever, and this guy's like, are you going to be my friend? And Max's like, I guess, like, you're cool, kind of, you're not out to kill me. And then that's all we see of him, and that's all the interaction they get. Like, no, don't go over there, you're gonna get killed, and that's it. And then fucking pig killer sends out his monkey with some water.
Yep.
For Max.
It was Max's monkey, right?
Oh, was it? I missed that.
Yeah, in the beginning of the movie, there's the monkey in the in the cart that Max has his camels on. That,
man, no memory.
So so Bruce Spence comes over, knocks Max off the thing, or doesn't knock him off, like, steals the carriage with the camels on it, and the monkey is in the back, and he throws the boots out so that Max has shoes to walk through the desert in.
Yes.
That's the same monkey. And then this carriage then goes down to the underworld. We see it in just a minute here, you know, earlier on. When
so
Max,
the convict releases the monkey?
Yes.
On purpose?
Yes.
He knows it's Max's monkey.
100%.
So that still doesn't necessarily answer my question. Is like, why does the convict give a shit?
I think he likes Max because Max stood up to Master Blaster and was a free man.
And he's like, that's cool. I'm going to release your monkey.
Exactly.
I love playing this game of like taking absurd things in a movie and having you justify them to me. It's just awesome.
I actually like it too because it makes me use my brain a bit. Because I was like, okay, let me think. Okay, this is what this probably is. Like,
it's great. Normally, I'm the one trying to justify absurd, stupid shit in movies. It's good. It makes sense. No, that makes sense. I did miss somehow. I don't know if I was making notes or whatever at the beginning of the movie that was actually Max's monkey. Where did Max get a monkey from? Well, you don't care. He has a monkey somehow.
Yep. And doesn't have a dog anymore.
No, the dog died in Road Warrior.
Yep. So he got a monkey to replace.
So he got a monkey instead.
Yep.
Okay, cool. I dig it. So then he's in the desert.
There's a the horse dies. There's a monkey jump scare.
Yes, there is a monkey jump scare. I forgot about that. Yep, that was fun. I think I had the same feeling when fucking Sam gives Frodo the water. Mel Gibson's out there and he's like, oh, thank God for all this water, and I'm going to dump it all over everywhere and half of it's not going to get into my mouth.
Yep.
Bro, take it easy.
Dude.
This is it. You can't waste half the water jug or canteen or whatever. But I do like the way that it was shot with when we like see this mysterious stranger on the horizon and the silhouette.
Absolutely. And I think the design's cool too with her walking sticks.
Yes.
It makes it kind of feel a little otherworldly.
Yes. Like, is this a shaman? Not hyperventilating, hallucinating this, is this a spirit guide? Are we going to go that way? Yeah. No, it's just a kid.
Just a teenage girl.
Yep. Roaming the gulag.
Yeah. Right. It's walking around that gulag. Cause that's definitely what it is. I forgot how much this movie is like Hook.
Dude.
Particularly when we meet the Lost Boys for the first time and we get our, the Rufio chants and.
Dude, I was going to say like there's so much. So we skipped because I have to talk about that. I have to call out this cheesy ass part, which I just laughed out loud at. She gets Mel Gibson and she goes like crests the, hill or whatever. And then she's like, and the music crescendos and swells and is like, bum, 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 bum.
It's wild, man.
It's so funny. And then like halfway across the gulag, little kid's like, like, what is happening?
Yeah, it's Katniss and Rue, man.
Dude, what is happening? What is this movie? Is what I wrote down in that moment.
Yeah, I think it's just very surprising because she stops. And then the camera kind of like zooms in on her and then it's just like,
and then my next note is, I have no memory of this place because I didn't have any memory that this is in this movie. And then my next note is, so now this is Hook. Great.
Yeah.
So much so, now I'm caught up with you, so much so that they actually say, fly, Walter, fly. And I was like, anyone else see? Is anyone else seeing this?
Hello?
Like, hello? Clearly, Steven Spielberg was very, very inspired by this movie. Between Indiana Jones and Hook. Fucking unbelievable.
Yeah.
Though I think
this Indy's movie before pulls, this, all right?
Well, Indy 2 is before this. Indy 3 is 92 or something, 93.
Right.
Last Crusade. So I do think that this movie actually pulls from Temple of Doom more than Last Crusade pulls from this movie. But it just is interesting, the connection between Spielberg and Hook and Indiana Jones and this movie is like they're all Spielberg movies.
Yeah.
So it makes me wonder, like, what if Spielberg had done this movie? You know?
Yeah.
It would have been.
It'd probably be a lot more hopeful.
Yeah, maybe. It'd be more cohesive, maybe.
I don't know. His movies can be bloated and and not cohesive at all.
Steven Spielberg's a saint.
Okay.
Is that wedding Crashers or Old School?
Yeah, Dorothy,
whatever's a saint.
Yeah, Dorothy.
Yeah, and so then like we're in this like Hook realm. They string him up. They get the like Rufio chant comes out. I do have that like Rufio is like one of my next notes in here.
And he comes like and sliding down like.
It's literally like shot for shot.
I know.
When Robin Williams goes to Neverland. Like, what is happening? Even so, like, there's a Wendy character. You have, like, a cute little, like, kid in a bear costume type character. Like, what is happening? You know?
Yeah. The only one that Hook doesn't have is there's not really a shaman. That, like, they don't have Screw Loose in Hook.
That's true. But they do... They do have some, we can't get into Hook right now. Like, what are we talking about? Like, there is some like weird, like religious thing is just not as dark as the Mad Max universe or whatever, but yeah,
totally
not because yeah, that shaman guy is weird too. I was like, what the fuck's this guy over here? I actually wrote down like, who's this Coco looking motherfucker?
Because, oh yeah. Well, I mean, you know,
Dia de los Muertos type thing.
Presumably it is just another, I the way I've always envisioned it since Fury Road came out is that this story is actually told from his point of view, from Screwloose's recollection of Max. And then we get another recollection from other war boys in Fury Road.
True.
Presumably
yeah, they do look very similar.
Yeah. The face paint is very similar. Mm. And the kind of shamanistic quality, you know, in Fury Road, I live, I die, I live again. And you know, they seem to have been corrupted more by a Morton Joe, and perhaps Screwloose is one of, you know, used to be a war boy or was supposed to be a war boy and escaped or something like that. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think it really matters. I think it just all goes to show that we're taught this story again is talking about the mythos of this world and this one character and how different people viewed him or heard his story or whatever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 'Cause obviously, you know, storytelling is a huge theme in this movie, as we're about to find out, like this idea that they tell the story of the apocalypse every night so that they don't forget it.
It's the true.
To be honest, when they brought out the movie screen, I was like, is this Simple Jack?
Yeah.
Oh no.
Is this the Tropic Thunder, you know, jungle retelling of Simple Jack?
Yeah, dude. My first thought was to Swiss Army Man when they like,
oh, sure.
Paul Dano tells fucking dead Harry Potter the story. And they set up the bus and how they all met fucking what?
Holy shit.
Can we just go watch Swiss Army Man right now again? I just love
it.
I do
want to watch that again.
Oh, it's so good.
That opening sequence with them just jetting across the water is so remarkable.
On his farts is so good. riding him like a dolphin. Ba 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 ba. Oh man, I'm so glad I was able to introduce you to that movie.
I do like the kind of details of this oral storytelling. And I think it's very cleverly written and I think it is logical in the sense of like how kids would think of things and construe things and then repeat things and mishear things and then repeat the misheard things. you know, Tomorrowland, mm-hmm. and, you know, The Gang Called Turbulence was my favorite.
Mm.
Or it could have been by A Gang Called Turbulence. Mm-hmm. The idea that they don't know what turbulence is, but they know that it's bad and attacked this plane and.
Right. Yeah, no, that's true. For all the shit that I have been giving this movie, I think one of my favorite parts of this is the language that was constructed for these Lost Boys. You know, like, because it.
And girls. We've been saying Lost Boys, but yes, Lost Boys and girls.
Right. Yeah, that's true. We've been saying Lost Boys as a character name to be totally clear to everybody that in Peter Pan, they are called the Lost Boys. There are some girls in Hook, and there are some girls in this tribe as well. Half, I think. Because I think
are there girls in Hook? Isn't the whole idea of Wendy that she's the only girl?
Yeah, there's Wendy and Tinkerbell. Julia Roberts is there. Glenn Close plays a pirate.
Oh, man.
Yeah, there's Wendy and Glenn Close plays a pirate.
That's what I'm saying, man. No, but to be completely honest, like, yeah, I the language construction of this was so I was really interested in it because it was fluent. It never like stuck out that it sounded weird the way that they were saying it, like the actors who were speaking in this sort of like tribal children of the corn, children of the gulag, you know, like language I thought was really well done. And yeah, the storytelling was really cool. It did make me like kind of focus in again, like, oh, okay, cool. I kind of want to know what's happening again. I do like, again, for the shit that we gave it, the like TV wooden rig, you know, screen, I thought that was really cool. Again, the, you know, if you're looking at 85, now we're like, electronics and TV and home video and all this stuff is starting to really become huge in the zeitgeist. So it would make sense that, you know, that would show up in the movies that are being made around the time too, you know? So yeah, I really did like that as well. I also enjoyed watching all of the background kid actors when it would be like cut to Mel Gibson in the center, like trying to like intently listen, and half the kids in the back, like fucking picking their nose, like not even like falling, just so not
staring
into what's
off
happening.
Into the distance.
Yeah. Like, when do we get to do something? I'm so bored.
I've been sitting here for 3 hours.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then my next note is, so they put the hat on Max. Max throws it and goes, "Da fuck."
Yeah. He's like, "No thanks.
This is, what are you talking about?"
Also, I mean, good on you. You guys are doing great. Congratulations for being alive. but I'm not the guy.
Right. Right. Interesting though that cave painting or whatever had him in like a Jesus figure, you know, when you're just talking about kids who may or may not have ever been exposed to religion, and the like open arms, the hug, the whatever that imagery is, and just history of society in general, history of humanity, being that welcoming figure that is seen across so many different religions is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good call out.
Thanks,
Brad. Yeah, you're welcome. The next thing that I would like to talk about
is Max's monkey. We'll go back to the monkey.
No, is the one of the iconic shots from the movie is the revelation of this plane, right? They go out to see the plane. And it's shot really well. It's kind of awestruck, you know, all inspiring rather when you happen upon it, and then watching Screw Loose get on the top of the tail fin.
Yeah, it's all backlit, just, like,
yeah.
The sun and the red and the secret lab and the
and you know, they're all lined across the hull and on the tail, you know, the wings of the tail, and Max just kind of stares at it and is just like, oh man, you guys, like, you really don't get it. He's like, that thing is not moving. And you don't understand that it's not moving.
Right.
And yeah, it's interesting to consider, like, the generational bridge, right, of somebody who is an adult before the Pox eclipse. And you know, at most, it seems like we're probably a few years removed from the Pox eclipse. And that, you know, even the oldest boy, who I assume is the oldest, you have his name over here on our sheet, which is Slake Mathurst. Which I read out of the corner of my eye as Slake McThirst, which just sounds like a terrible, like, porn bot on the internet.
McThirst trap.
Yeah. but yeah, this, the whole idea of, you know, before they go to the plane, he's like, you guys have to understand that, like, there is nothing out there. All of the cities, the Tomorrowland, it's gone. This is home now. This is your home. This is, and you've done a great job with it. Like, you have to be okay with where you are. Yeah. And he doesn't have the heart really to tell them after they get brought to the plane that it's not what you think. Like, you got, like,
it's a false idol.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There is no hope to have.
Yeah. No, and it makes sense because correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that, like, the nuclear war and apocalypse that happens before Road Warrior. Because in that opening, they, with all of the old footage, they end up showing an atomic bomb at the end of it.
Yeah, I think so.
So, like, I don't think that the, I don't, in the, if we're trying to find a chronology here, I don't think that the world has drastically changed between the time of Road Warrior and Thunderdome. Except to say, to go further into Apocalypse Land, because the nukes have already been dropped.
Yeah, I think the big change is that all consumable resources are pretty much gone.
Yeah, right.
Like, even the gasoline that was scarce is now gone.
Right.
I mean, we see Max using camels at the beginning of the movie. It's not even worth searching for.
So. But if that's true, and these kids were born after the big boom boom, as it were, then that would mean that there's, like, I mean, the oldest of those kids,
it's probably 14. Flake
and Thirst and Savannah Nix. I mean, maybe old. I mean, they might be 16, 17, you know, depending. They're certainly, like, teenagers still, but that's to say that it's been 15 years between Road Warrior and Beyond Thunderdome is what I'm saying. Maybe.
Mm.
Yeah, a good maybe. Amount of time has passed. Which was something I never tracked in these movies is the time passage, because it feels like between 1 and 2 there's not that much time that passes, but between Road Warrior and Thunderdome, at, you know, it could be a decade that has passed between those two stories.
And I feel a little bit differently. I feel like there's more time between 1 and 2 and less time between 2 and 3.
Interesting. Yeah, I kind of, like, especially after watching the Man with No Name trilogy, I kind of wish that they did that, followed that with Max, where, like, they kind of embrace it more in this movie, where I think you only hear his name once in the whole movie.
Yeah.
But I think it would be really cool to kind of what you were mentioning earlier, like, embrace the mythos of this wanderer and really go fully into this idea that these, like, we're just tracking people's memories of this legend. I mean, like a Robin Hood type character too, you know, like that type of thing, or, you know, instead 100%. Of being like looking at these movies as a, okay, so this happened in Max's life, then 10 years passed, and then he's the Road Warrior, and then 10 years passed, and now he's in Thunderdome, and, you know. And I only bring that up because it's like a preview of coming attractions for next week, because I'm curious, after watching all these in a row, where we'll end up, if we can, end up placing Fury Road in Max's timeline or not, which I'm not getting get into right now, but I am curious about having that conversation next week.
Yeah, totally.
Cool. Moving forward. Yeah, the giant plane was fucking cool as hell. All of that to say. In the scope of it, man, like, thank God that they, like, used a giant ass thing to, you know.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to do, like, a model or, you know, like, those kids are standing on.
On something.
On something huge. Yeah.
Yeah. They're standing on something.
Yeah.
Cool. That is not a, likely not a just green log in a studio somewhere.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And then is one of the sequences in the movie that kind of really, for me, makes this movie really start to drag. Where the tribe that, you know, they go back to the camp, they have their little power tussle between Savannah and Max, and she's like, I'm going, there's something out there for us, we have to try. And Max is like, listen, there's nothing there, I've please listen to me.
Yeah, right. The closest thing you'll find is Bartertown, and that's a horrific place. You're like, you're good here, you got water
or whatever. Yeah,
you're like, you're living the dream here, fucking stay here, we're staying here.
Yeah, and then, you know, then Max goes to sleep and gets waken up, and they find out that he left during the night. Then we go on this trek, and then we have our little, like, who's going to go with him thing. And, you know, they all take their water satchels, and then we trek across the desert, and then we find the people. And then the kid's getting eaten by the sand. Just in the nick of time, Max shows up and pulls Savannah out of its quicksand. And then she pulls... you know, she tries to pull the other kid, but loses grip, and he ends up dying in the sand. And then we have the weirdest cut to black. It, like, it doesn't make any sense. It just, like, cuts to black, which is something that, like, doesn't happen in these movies. And it's not like a really a new chapter has started, or a new, we aren't going to a new area. We're still continuous in our timeline. Like, a kid just died, but, and, like, why are we cutting to black? Sorry, was that callous?
The wrong kid died. That's a Walk Hard quote for anyone paying attention and following along. Wrong kid died.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the only thing I have to say about this is I'm a sucker for sunset shots. I've been saying that for every time we've had a sunset shot on the podcast. I get it. Some of it's cheesy, some of it doesn't work, but either way, I'm like, man, when they're like traipsing through the desert on the like hills of the sand dune or whatever, and it's at sunset, it's super brief, but I just,
yeah,
I love it. I just love those shots. It's so cool. Yeah, that fade to black, that cut to black, I agree. Like, when you said that, I was like, right, it kind of flashed back to my memory of watching the movie. I was like, oh shit, did the TV go out? Did the Blu-ray stop? Like, what?
What? It's weird.
We're here again. Like, yeah, just like, it was jarring.
It's almost like they didn't. I don't know.
It's like they filmed the extra 20 minutes of scene that this movie needs was right there. And they're like, well, we don't have a good transition anymore, so we'll just cut to black. And now it's the next day.
And they're sleeping, which, whatever. Like, yeah. This movie, I'm so exasperated.
I know. It has such potential to be really fucking cool. And there are some really fucking cool moments, but
yeah.
My next note is, and now it's Indiana Jones 2.
Exactly. We're in back in the underworld. We're in pipes. We're doing all sorts of minecart stunts and
yeah, dude. Yep. Absolutely.
Slides all around and
yeah, slides.
Yeah.
What was up with that slide?
It's a chute for grain for the pigs.
Well, I know, but like, it was like a water slide. It was like an amusement park.
Yeah, and it did look like whoever did the stunt like went down with their arms crossed, like they were doing a wall. Like,
that's what I'm saying, man. It's like, what is happening? Yeah.
I do think a huge missed opportunity in this movie happens with this underworld. No, they kind of get at it by theoretically lowering Master down into the pigs. Yep. The fact that they don't dispose of a body by letting the pigs eat it is a huge missed opportunity.
Dude, seriously, I was totally expecting that is what was happening. I was like, oh man, that's fucking gruesome. And then they pull him up and I was like, so he just got like a bunch of kisses from these pigs? Like your
sweet pig kisses.
Sweet little pig kisses? Are we doing like a pit of puppies? Like he probably was like, no, lower me back down. They were very nice and cuddly. Like, if they're not going to eat you, then they must be very nice pigs.
I was about to ride one.
Hi ho, Silver, away! Oh, man. Horrible. Yeah, no, I agree completely. At least, if they're not going to eat him completely and kill off the character, at least he has to come up with some bloody arms and some bites and some cuts and bruises or something.
Yeah.
You know, it looked like they like embraced him as one of their own and was like, you will now lead us. You
know? Or even one of the guys in this scene, one of the evil henchmen or the blacksmith or whatever, like instead of though, what's his face with the little doll attached to his back, getting schlepped into the pig shit is gag inducing.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I can't.
Yeah. It's just so weird, like how much this movie just reminds me of Army of Darkness and Indiana Jones and Hook, and like it doesn't remind me of any other like Mad Max movie. Like it's just and Waterworld,
yeah, Star
like,
Wars.
Yeah. Yeah, you could definitely tell that the producers saw what was profitable in a Harrison Ford-esque adventure between Star Wars and Indiana Jones, and you're like, this is the movie you're making, you know?
Yeah.
Which I think part of the reason why Fury Road toiled away for 20 years. Because he started writing and trying to make Fury Road in like the mid to late 90s, I think, is when he like started, you know, so it's like, but it makes sense because he's like, I don't want to make this shit. I want to make Mad Max, you know, I want to make Road Warrior and that's where I want to live in, you know?
Yeah, right.
Because then my next one was fucking finally some cool cars and a chase scene. Like, this is why I want to watch Mad Max. I don't want to watch it for like kids telling me about the true and whatever, like, you know.
Yeah, no, I have the same, you know, finally some fucking cars, man.
Yes.
You know, and a train and a plane. We get all of the transportation methods in this.
Yes, we do.
I do love the guy with the doll on his back doing the pump cart to chase the train down.
Yeah, dude, that guy was going fucking nuts. I'm like,
yeah,
these cars are going 70 miles an hour, you know, supposedly whatever, to like catch up. And this guy is leading the cars with a hand truck or whatever. Yeah.
He essentially is like Wes's little brother. Just like, because you could totally look back there and see Wes on that thing just fucking going ape shit.
Yeah, with a mohawk, with his mohawk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But even I think this is like, for me, clearly, this is the part where it like this really works the most is in the cart scene where you're like, oh yeah, this feels good. This feels like it makes sense. And there are still some parts in it where I'm like, the kids find the record player and they put on that like record and then it's like a French lesson.
Teaching them to teach French. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess like, okay, that's cool. But like we linger on them for a while as they're just like repeating French and English words. And I'm like, Why are we doing this? Right. I want to go back to those cool cars out there and see what's happening with that and not hear these kids right. be like,
I want to see Tina Turner driving a jet powered car
with her huge hair and shoulder pads and like, rah! Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. But they do have a cowhide Corvette.
Yes, they do.
Fucking hilarious.
Yeah, it's wild, man.
It's like, what?
Yeah, that's awesome. I really like that. Yeah. And a lot of these stunts are really fun. The jumping to and from the train, the just climbing all over it. I do feel bad for the way they manhandle Master in this. But it's, you know, comes with the territory, I suppose.
Yeah, like, and just like throwing him back and forth, and then Mad Max like Tarzan swinging from cart to cart and like grabbing him or whatever. Yeah, I did have some mixed feelings about that too. I'm like, I don't know if this is exploitative or misrepresentation or anything like that, or if it's like, well, this is just a human that we're trying to not let these other people murder.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, I like the gimmick of the blacksmith pulling the pin and then having to hold the cars together with his own body strength.
Mm-hmm. Pull the pin. Shink, hold it together. Hold the car. Hold it. He's like, God damn it. Fucking make up your mind.
I like the javelin that goes through the driver's leg.
Oh, dude. No, it's like a gun, right?
It's like a spear gun, like a whaling gun.
A whaling gun, yeah. I was trying to think of the term.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, his reaction to that where he's just like, shkink, and he's like, he just looks down and sees it like through his femur, and you're like, oh, fuck that, man. Out. Nope. No, thank you.
That doesn't feel good.
No, it does not.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of other little... You know, Screw Loose getting onto the car is great. Max getting onto his car is great. You know, I wish there was more. I wish there was a little bit more like vehicle stunt work. Like we get our, you know, I love all the vehicles tailing the train and stuff, but I do miss some of the motorcycle jumps and shit like that. And I think really I'm just looking forward to next week.
Oh yeah, dude. Same.
But this is one of the scenes that inspires that movie too. Like it just the shape of it.
Yeah.
Is go for it.
No, I should say there is something to your, to that extent, the shape of it that made me think of how cool it is that George Miller sets for the first time in our Mad Max movies or whatever, the train can't go off the tracks. Like he sets that confinement of like, we're being chased, but we can only go straight on these tracks. And that's right. It.
We can't take a jump. We can't pull a U-turn. We can't even tip this thing really if we wanted to.
No. And I think that's just in this moment, I had the realization of how cool that is, setting that parameter on Max, you know, and
no, it works really well, right? Like it disallow, it makes the space more confined, and it makes it all that much more you know, life threatening and implausible that they escape.
Right.
So yeah, and then you know they're rolling along and then they encounter Gyro's kid.
You mean Honey Bunny? If any of you all fucking move.
Oh, yeah, right. He pulls the Amanda Plummer, right?
Yeah, he's like, stick him up. If any of you fucking move, I'll blow every one, the last one of you away, up. I guess I got to add one more word into that. We can't talk about people blowing each other if they don't move.
Right.
I'll blow especially, away every last one of you.
Especially when it's like a 7-year-old boy.
Yeah. And it's Max and a bunch of other kids. Like, that's it. And a fucking pig killer. But even then it was like so fucking weird where you're like, okay, so the thing, like we crawl to a stop or whatever, and then there's just like Jedediah Jr. Just like hanging out, waiting for the train to come to try and like do the great train robbery. And then they're like, yeah, no, bro. Like, we're not. No, I think that he sees like the, all the cars coming or whatever. He's like, oh, fuck this. He's out. And they're like, yeah, we'll follow this guy. And then we get this really weird thing where like Max goes, you.
And we're like, he is the, no, never mind.
Yeah, right. I'm like, he, did, do they know each other?
He's just referencing that he's the one that stole his carriage at the beginning of the movie.
Earlier in the movie. But like, apparently the reason that they cast, Bruce Spence.
Bruce Spence.
Is because the breakdown, they were looking for a Bruce Spence type and they couldn't find anyone. And so then they were like, well, let's just call up Bruce and see if he'll do it. And he was like, all right.
Sweet. I'll play another pilot.
Yeah, absolutely. In a giant ass, like, you know, huge budget film and, you know, blockbuster 80s film or whatever. All right, cool.
Yeah.
But it's just like a really weird casting choice. Like, we've seen it. We saw it in Man with No Name trilogy, right? The multiple, you know, vegan Cleef playing a couple of different characters and the Italian guy who's the bad guy in the first one playing a couple of different characters.
I can't remember his name.
But it didn't bother me as much in those, like, because it was never like these aren't supposed to be chronological. It was very clear that these are not the same person, but it's the same archetype of a person.
Yeah.
But the it doesn't work at all for Jedediah the pilot versus
Gyro Captain
is, you know.
It just is odd that they're both, like, the thing that makes it the most confusing is that they are both pilots.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Like, that's, if they are not both pilots, totally different story.
Right. Yep. Yeah, because there's no, like, ooh, Toe Cutter went on to become a Morton Joe. Like, there's none of that type of questioning, you know. Like, they're very different characters or whatever. Yeah, I agree. This is another, like, this whole after this train sequence is the thing I didn't remember, the whole, like, chicken with the plane and this whole thing. So then, you know, my note is, no way that plane takes off with that much weight. And then I wrote, okay, yep. That's, I'm glad. I was like, if this fucking thing takes off and soars off into the distance with 25 children in this tiny ass little thing, like, no.
Which I did account, they lost at least like 3 kids along the way.
I mean,
they didn't even make it into the plane.
Survival of the fittest, man.
You know, it's like 9 people or whatever get on the train and only 6 go through the trunk of the car. So including the guy that had the fucking whale harpoon stuck through his leg. So
no, he made it into the plane, right?
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Oh, like, I see.
They didn't like, sorry, dude, you're lame and old and let's save the kids instead. It's like, no, we're just going to forget about these kids.
Pig Killer's out for himself, man. He's like, look, you guys can't keep up. But it's a good point because they could have fit like 4 kids in the space that one convict picked, you know, up in that plane. And then I wrote chicken. Let's go.
Yeah, I do love, I mean, this is the quintessential Mad Max shot from this movie, though, right? Is the lineup of Auntie Entity's cars on the runway facing the plane, you know, spread the entire length of the frame. Like, you look at that and you know immediately what movie it's from. You're like,
yeah,
that is 100% from Mad Max.
Yep. And while you're watching the movie, as soon as you see that shot, you know exactly what's about to happen. You're like, we're going to get a standoff, a chicken standoff here. Like, this is going to happen. And it doesn't disappoint, man. When Max like dives out of the thing at the last second, and that crash that just decimates is so fucking cool.
Yeah.
Man, is it cool.
Yeah. The way they capture it too, and you just get to see the crumpling and all the different pieces flying and shit.
Yeah. Like, literally, yeah, you see the metal crumple on the hood and you just see it just go, these two immovable objects just like, holy shit. So cool. So cool. And again, forgive me if I'm going too fast, but then Max is on the side of the road, and then Tina Turner comes up and she's like, good one, and then just leaves.
You're like, respect you.
What? That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it doesn't really.
Seems completely out of character for Auntie Entity, who's like, you know, only one enters, you know, two enter, one shall leave. And, you know, like, if you break the deal, face the wheel or whatever. And you're like, you betrayed me. You ruined my town. You took away all my power source. You took away all of this. You took away all of that. Respect. What?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I was like, did I miss something? Like,
the only thing I can think of is somehow she realizes that he's doing all of this to save the kids. Kind of.
I think it's like what you just started with. It's just like a respect amongst warriors type thing of like, you know, you are my equal. We fought hard. It was a good battle. You know, respect. Because you're a badass.
Right. I'll let you live out here in the middle of the desert. Find your own fucking way home.
Yeah. Never come back. But like, yeah. Another great sunset shot of Max walking in the sunset.
Yep.
I'm a sucker for him.
Our lonesome warrior.
Yep. But now he has a heart and he saved the children's.
He saved a few of the children's. Let's not forget that he also left like 24 of them in a fucking small oasis in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, but they got a good life, man. They're in the small oasis. Yeah. They're in fucking Never Never Land.
They've got water.
Yeah, which is huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
And who's to say he's not going back to the Chillins?
That's true. We'll never know.
Gotta restart the human race somehow, right? Ooh, it got dark. Got really dark. Mad Max 4.
We can let the teenagers do that themselves.
Yeah, right.
He doesn't have to be involved.
You know, he's going to become like Grandpa Max. So it's just like, get off my lawn.
Yeah, then we kind of get our final shots of the movie here with our flyover of Sydney, Australia post-pox eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
Completely decimated and uninhabited, and except for our band of nomadic children that have taken up residence in skyscrapers for some odd fucking reason.
Because they have to rebuild humanity, Brett, and they're gonna like honor the past by becoming the future and
all getting civil engineering degrees.
Yeah, exactly right. Because they've forgotten more than these kids will ever know. So they have to. Yep.
Great.
And we will now name it Maxtown. Maxton. Yep. Yeah. And my last two notes. First one is it says for Byron at the end. And I always am curious when they, you know, that's like before the credit. Anytime that there's something like that, I'm always like, okay, that's gotta be someone important. And that's the friend producer that died.
I presumed that after you said that.
Yep. And then my last note is what a weird fucking movie.
Yeah. It's kind of insane.
Yeah.
I kept using the word wild tonight a lot. And it's a wild movie.
It really is, man.
It's a mess. It's the thing is though, like it's still entertaining.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's not like understandable or cogent or necessarily good, but it's entertaining.
So, well, that brings to the next question, which I'm having a real struggle with. When do you watch Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome?
When it's the only one on a streaming service and the others aren't.
And you want to watch a Mad Max movie?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, in kind of all seriousness, yeah. I don't know. I think it has its kind of like campy. Like this falls in the camp of like good, bad movies for me.
Yep.
I feel like this is a good one to add to that list of, you know, a movie that takes zero effort, is kind of enjoyable. It can also be like memed to death.
Yes.
As well.
In fact, there were a shit ton of memes that I saw this past week that were all Beyond Thunderdome related, of just like on the top, it was Tina Turner and all of her people. And on the bottom, it was all of the people like filling gas bags with, or filling trash bags with gasoline in fucking North Carolina or whatever.
Yep.
So yeah, memed to death is very true. Yeah, I feel the same, man. I feel like that this occupies that perfect space of like, you know, I'm going to be doing my week's worth of cooking on this Sunday evening and making, you know, all of my meals, or I'm you know, working on the car in the garage, or I'm, you know, cleaning the house or anything like that, where this movie is good to like have on as background noise in that way, where you can tune in to the fun parts and be like, you know, I don't know. Stop doing the dishes to like go watch this chase scene and then go back and continue watching or whatever.
Yeah.
I also feel like this is like the perfect like TNT USA on TV movie with like the commercials and, you know, just like have it on in the background when you're doing laundry or whatever. Because it is fun and it's still like is an enjoyable watch. And, you know, like you can tune out when they're like traipsing through the desert or whatever. Judi Dench.
What?
Did you see Judi Dench in this movie? She was really good in this movie.
She was really great. She was the blind saxophone player.
Yeah. she got really into the role, man.
This is kind of hard. I think I might give it to Mel Gibson here.
Wow.
Because I actually think we don't really talk about it a lot because he doesn't have a lot to say, but I actually think he does a pretty good job in this movie. In terms of taking these ridiculous scenarios that he's found himself in this series, and doing the best he can with them. There's some pretty compelling stuff with the children of the forest too, or whatever they're called. I'm going to give it to Mel. I think this is my last opportunity to give it to him as well. So.
Yeah, it's tough for me too. I think, I'm fucking hell, man. I think my gut feeling on this is that I'm going to give it to Helen Boudet. She is the one who's the female leader of the child tribe of the children of the forest of Hobbiton. I think her intensity, I mean, and because like two-thirds of this movie revolves around the child tribe and that whole storyline. I feel like, you know, we talked about her language skills and the stakes are really big for her. And so I think she's the one that sort of like drops the mic with the performance for me. The runner-up is Mel Gibson's wig, because that thing is fucking epic.
And might have a pulse.
Yeah.
It might still be alive.
It might still be alive. Yep, I think so. I think so. Man, that first shot when he like turns around and it's like, oh! I wish they would have just gone with that for the whole fucking movie, man. Like, use that as a theme where you just like every once in a while you just hear this. Oh! Cool. So that's Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, y'all.
Y'all.
Y'all, that's Mad Max. And that's the end of our Mel Gibson Mad Max trilogy, though.
Yes.
We have another Monday in May. It's Memorial Day. So to memorialize Mad Max, we're going to do Mad Max Fury Road. Add to the mythos, Mr. Bolton.
Of the movies in the buff. And we're going to redux it, too.
That's right. That's true. Yep, I'm going to... I'm just going to put the other one on speaker and let you respond to whatever I said. I'm taking Memorial Day off, y'all. I already did that once, man. I'm not doing this again. Okay. You want to do it again? Fine.
Yeah, I'll just monologize for it. I'll get it done in 45 minutes.
Just straight talking, no rest.
I could do a 45 minute lecture on that movie for certain.
Dude, without a doubt. Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. That's why these podcasts are 2 hours long, because each of us give hour long lectures on these movies. Yes. Yeah, so all of that's to say, next week we're going to end our Mad Max May on Memorial Day with Mad Max Fury Road. I'm super excited to watch it. I haven't watched it in long enough where I'm like, I'm so fucking excited to watch it. It's so good. I can't wait to watch it again. So follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Movies in the Buff, Twitter, Buff Movies, email watchingmoviesinthebuff@gmail.com. Let us know your favorite Mad Max movie, your favorite Mad Max moment, and give us some more suggestions.
Some more Mad Max Michigash.
Great. I guess I'll go first. Listen all. This is the truth of it. Fighting leads to killing, and killing gets to warring. And that was damn near the death of us all. Look at us now, busted up and everyone talking about hard rain. But we've learned by the dust of them all. Baby town learned. Now, when men get to fighting, it happens here and it finishes here. Two men enter, one man leaves.
The first place you'll find is a sleaze pit called Babytown. Now, if the earth doesn't swallow you up first, that place sure as hell will.
Yeah. Oh, man. Can somebody who listens please do like a mock-up of Babytown? Like, I want like some sort of fun...
Just a map.
map of Babytown. Somebody, yeah. Please. I'm begging you.
That'd be really fun.
Like, I want to know, like, what is a normal Friday night in Bartertown? Like, everyone's yeah. like, oh, no, Thunderdome's happening. And so I'm like, well, shit, I made dinner already. Like, what? I had other plans.
It's going to go shoot womp rats.
Yeah, right. Like,